Your girlfriend Jenny cringes as you hear a loud pop and your tire goes flat. She chides you for driving recklessly, but you swear you're doing your best. Privately, however, you're just as fearful as she is. The dirt road is suspicious at best, with its sharp rocks and rain-eroded potholes. You get out, the sleet-like rain instantly chilling you to your bones, and check your cell phone for service. Nothing. You exhale, afraid to admit to Jenny that you do not know how to change a tire. But then, you see a vehicle approaching at the distance. As it gets closer, you realize it's definitely not a car. It's a wagon. A real covered wagon. Straight out of those Oregon Trail games you used to play. This must mean you're getting close. You've heard the reenactors here are top-notch. But as the wagon approaches, something about it makes you uneasy. These actors are not the grinning tourist pleasers you'd expect. They look hardened, angry even. The two men in the front seat glare at you. Their faces and hands are dirty, their beards spiky and clumped. They say nothing, but they gesture for you to climb the back. There's a woman seated there, clothed in an old-fashioned dress and bonnet. Something is swaddled in her arms. You don't want Jenny to see it, but you're truly scared. This was supposed to be a quick, fun weekend trip. Already you feel uneasy about abandoning your vehicle on this unknown road, but your options are limited. But wait, is that... Yes, finally you see it. Jenny lets out a gasp of wonder. There, stretched out before you in the valley below, a ghost town. It's bigger than you ever imagined. You've arrived at your destination, Bodie State Historic Park. You've made it in one piece. Despite the weather, you're going to make the best of it. But as you and Jenny leave the wagon and walk toward the town, you're unaware of the number one rule of the mountain. Many go up, few come back down. Welcome to Haunted Places. I'm Greg Polson. Every Thursday, I take you to the scariest, eeriest, most haunted, real places on Earth. This week, join me on a supernatural journey to the ghost town of Bodie in Bodie State Historic Park. To this day, it's haunted. If you can't get enough haunted places, don't forget to subscribe. You can find us on your favorite podcast directory, as well as on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast, and on Twitter at Parcast Network. If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. Bodie, California is an abandoned gold rush town that was founded in 1859 by W.S. Bodie. From 1860 to 1941, the mines surrounding the town produced just under $34 million in gold and silver. The town reached its zenith in 1879. When the largest deposit of gold was discovered, and the population swelled to 7,000. From the years 1879 to 1881, crime in Bodie reached such a fever pitch that the town became better known for its criminals than its gold. In 1964, Bodie was officially dedicated as a California state park. And in the years following, the Bodie Foundation would work to keep the town in a state of arrested decay, that is, keeping the buildings from collapsing, but otherwise leaving them unchanged. The only living inhabitants are a few park rangers year-round. The visitor center was easy to miss. It's built into one of the old buildings, indistinguishable from the dozens of empty stores, houses, and churches you saw on your way in. A strange black carriage is the centerpiece of the room. You're not sure what it would have been used for. You also notice a doll's head in a case, surrounded by marbles. The crack across the toy's face gives it a sinister look. The lights in the room suddenly flicker on. As your eyes adjust, you see a plump woman with long gray hair, dressed in a ranger's uniform. She seems friendly overall, and you ask her about your car. She frowns with disapproval and tells you it's too late to get any service now. You would have to deal with it in the morning. She tells you that you can stay the night in the visitor center and asks if you want to hear a story to pass the time. You supposed there's nothing that can be done, lest you want to hike back through the freezing rain. You take a seat opposite her and lean back to listen. William groaned as yet another scoop of dirt yielded little more than some rocks and a minnow. As he released the fish into the river, his stomach flipped. His heart sunk. There, at the bottom of the river, was a face. Hideous and dark. It stared right at him. He stood up, the bones clicking in his back after hours of being hunched over the river. It was then that he realized he'd been startled by his own reflection. The sudden sight of all 7 feet of William shocked his mule, old Peter, who took off down the river. The prospector's height and hygiene led him to occasionally be mistaken for a beast. As William made his way to the end of the river, he found that old Peter had luckily been captured by Taylor. Though not as tall as William, Taylor was part Cherokee, and thus had a similarly dark complexion. Taylor was a useful partner, even if William didn't always enjoy sharing the take. William inquired as to the location of their other two partners, Doyle and Garrity. Taylor, characteristically silent, nodded back up the riverbank. William found his remaining two companions above the river in the hills. They worked furiously against the earth. Drawing closer, William's eyes widened to see the glint of gold beneath them. The foursome circled arms, patting each other on the back. The men spent the entire day making their plans for the site. They would begin work on a cabin tomorrow, which they would use as a base to mine what they could until winter came. That was, unfortunately, only a few weeks away. And so they resolved to tell no one of the spot and return in spring once the snows had melted. That night, William could have sworn he heard voices on the wind. They laughed and taunted him, warning him to stay away. "The gold belongs to someone else," they said, "and you shall never have it." He woke up in a great sweat that only bolstered him with a stubborn determination. It took the rest of the fall to finish the cabin. It stood in the center of the valley, an anomaly amidst a sea of green brush. The men, satisfied with their work, began the long hike back down to Mono Lake. They shared a drink at the Mono Lake Inn before Doyle and Garrity departed for Sacramento. William and Taylor would depart later that afternoon, when the sun had died some. Or at least, that's what they told the other men. As soon as Doyle and Garrity cleared the horizon, they headed right for the general store. William purchased extra equipment and supplies, which Taylor loaded onto old Peter. They headed back up into the hills. The path to the cabin was longer than William remembered. He felt tired, as though being dragged down by a great and forceful weight. The voices came again. "It's all wrong," they said. "All wrong. You must leave or you will wake him. Winter is his time to sleep." William's head felt thick and viscous with the cacophony of whispers as rain began to fall. and immediately cut a chill right down to his toes. Soon, the rain turned to snow that fell with urgency. The thick veil covered their vision. "It's him. He's here. You must go back." Taylor watched the silhouette of William drop to his knees and collapse in the snow. He ran to the body, but realized to his dismay that the snow had already started to bury him. Taylor's hands were numb, and he could not get a grip on his large friend to lift him. He thought to use his mule, Peter, but by the time he found the animal and returned, William's body was completely buried, and all Taylor could see was an endless white floor. Taylor continued toward the cabin, face ducked against the torrential storm, praying he was walking in the right direction. When the dark shape of the building finally did emerge from the blizzard, Taylor didn't even bother finding the barn to tie up Peter, but instead brought him inside the cabin. Taylor and the mule both huddled next to the fire, while Taylor shakily prepared a can of beans. The tips of his fingers and toes were blackened. His body stung as his limbs thawed. When the sounds came, Taylor was having trouble keeping his eyes open. His head was light. His limbs ached. It was the door. William must have made it after all. Taylor was too cold and exhausted to feel anything. He sauntered to the door and opened it. Peter panicked. The mule reared and banged his head against the ceiling. He trotted back and forth, crashing into the walls. Taylor looked, but nothing was out there. Nothing but the terrible, oppressive wind. The mule stood in the corner, trembling. Blood streaked between his eyes where his head knocked the ceiling. The ice that covered the mule's fur was melting into a puddle on the ground. The noises continued. Taylor shut his eyes against them, praying for them to stop, praying for sleep to come. He opened his eyes at the tapping on the window. There was the face of William Bodie, body frozen and lifeless, spindly fingers drumming against the glass. At the sight of the demon, old Peter the mule dropped dead. The storm continued. The days passed. Taylor sliced at parts of the mule and cooked him over the fire. The rest of the animals started to rot. The stink was almost unbearable. But Taylor was too weak to drag himself outside. That, and he was too afraid to open the door. Every night, William's frozen corpse returned, tapping against the window. Every night, Taylor refused to let him in. When the storm finally let up, Taylor made sure to leave the cabin in the light of the day, while his dead friend slept beneath the snow. In spring, Taylor returned to the cabin. He would bury William once and for all. He would assure his ghost would haunt him no more. He found what was left of William's corpse, just his bones and his knife, revolver, and blanket. Taylor wrapped everything in the blanket and buried William on the spot. William was dead. Bodie is nestled east of the Sierra Nevada mountain range in Northern California, almost to the Nevada border. Its geography means its winters are especially harsh and long-lasting. Temperatures can reach 40 below zero with icy storms and 100 mile an hour winds. For Bodie, its blizzards are a grim reaper, sucking the heat from even the most warmly dressed person, turning their blood to jelly, their skin to glass. William Bodie, the man credited with founding the town, learned this the hard way. In November of 1859, he returned to Bodie and found himself caught in a snowstorm. His body failed him, and he was too large for his partner, E.S. Taylor, to carry to safety. William froze to death, his body buried beneath the snow. When Taylor returned in the spring, he found William's body, torn apart by animals, his ribs exposed and dripping with whatever rotten meat the animals hadn't picked clean. He buried William in a makeshift grave. In 1879, when curious townsfolk were eager to see the remains of their city's namesake, they exhumed William's remains and hung them on display in the center of town. We'll return to our story in just a moment from the Parcast Network. And now, back to the story. Though William had died, others heard of his gold discovery. And by 1868, there were two mining camps located on the land. The town was named after its presumed first resident, though miners at the time were not aware that William hadn't discovered the claim alone. By 1879, significant gold deposits had been unearthed in Bodie, and a Wild West town was born. Many men showed up in Bodie just to gamble at one of the many saloons. Most popular was the Saloon of John Wagner. Truly, no venue was more Wild West than Wagner's saloon. Every night, the bar was packed from wall to wall. The gambling took place in the back, with such wild characters as Madame Mustache, known for her card skills and hairy upper lip, or Mike Maneater McGowan, known for chewing body parts off of those who offended him. As soon as a gun went off, the more honest patrons of the saloon would stampede from the premises, often tearing off the doors in the panic. Those who didn't die were patched up by John Wagner's wife, an experienced surgeon. Despite these many horrific shootings, the most famous shooting in Bodie took place not at the saloon, but on the opposite side of town, in the Miners' Union Hall, where the visitor center now stands. Joseph DeRoche downed two whiskeys as he watched John Wagner's wife stitch up Don Riley's stomach, where Chase Singer stabbed him with his pocket knife. Blood dripped through the crevices of wood on the bar top and wrapped around Joseph's shot glass. Joseph watched the woman's masterful hands weave the needle in and out of the flesh of the man's stomach. It was a bad omen, this happening so close to Christmas, so close to the heart of winter. Joseph left the bar and went to find comfort in the only place he knew where to look. He watched Johanna Treloar from across the dance hall. In truth, she wasn't much prettier than his wife in Chicago, but the grime of the West made the comfort of any woman welcome. The Miners' Union Hall Christmas Ball was a classy affair. He knew he wasn't supposed to dance with her, but he could hardly wait. That freak of a husband of hers be damned. Fueled by the whiskey in his blood, he approached her and swung her into his arms. When they danced, they felt alone and happy. They twirled and twirled, lost to each other. But then they turned a final time and saw Thomas Treloar standing across the dance floor, a look of anger on his face. Johanna immediately tried to placate her husband, but he wouldn't have it. And Joseph couldn't blame him. The half-wit already knew they were sleeping together. Treloar cocked his hand and struck her, right there at the ball, in front of the whole town. Joseph left and replayed the scene in his mind, Johanna fleeing, ashamed and in tears. Her husband red with fury. Joseph knew what must be done. He shivered as he waited in the alley of the dance hall. 10 minutes later, he almost missed Thomas as he walked past the alley and down Main Street. He still had his gun on him from the trip to Wagner's earlier in the day. Its sleek barrel caught the moonlight. He stalked behind the small, pathetic man and took aim. Thomas dropped immediately. A crowd gathered around the grisly scene. Joseph felt nothing but relief as they took him to prison. Jail didn't hold him long. Joseph knew where the crawlspace to freedom was. Hell, the whole town knew. He shuffled down Main Street, with his coat pulled high and his hat brim low. He passed a crowd, but they barely noticed him. Joseph made his way out of town. He would sleep in the woods. He knew about a cabin north of Mono Lake. He would wait for the whole thing to blow over, then send for Johanna when things were quiet. When he saw the cabin, he breathed a sigh of relief. Few knew about this place. Fewer still would think to look here on the first night. He took a step, but his foot was stuck. A frozen blue hand had shot through the ground and gripped Joseph's boot. He struggled uselessly against it. He could feel the ice-cold fingers through his insulated leather shoe. It made his toes numb. He heaved with all his might until he slipped out of his boot. He turned to run, but another hand gripped his other foot. With the same effort, Joseph pulled his second foot free. He ran toward the cabin, ignoring the icy sticks and debris that stabbed at his bare, frozen feet. He was 100 paces away. 50. Relief swarmed over him. So filling was it that he did not notice the pile of bones on the ground. Bones of a mule that was never buried. He tripped and flew through the air. His head crashed against the hard, frozen ground. Joseph startled awake to see several men standing over him. They were dark shadows, their features incomprehensible. He'd tried to tell them to leave him be. The undead were here. They were coming for him. They laughed a long, demonic laugh. They wrapped a rope around his feet and started to drag him back to Bodie. He felt the frozen ground through his clothing. Sticks and rocks ripped his shirt and cut his arms. His head felt light. He looked up at the men and saw a blue frozen figure walking next to them, whispering in their ears. It turned to look upon Joseph and smiled. A mocking smile. They dragged him through town, through the terrible judging eyes of the crowd. He tried to focus his eyes. Johanna was in the street, watching with horror. The people looked possessed, their eyes red with judgment and hatred. They looked twisted, hellish, and supernatural. They cackled and screamed. Their faces shifted and changed. Some were horned, some rotting. They were the spirits of Bodie's violent past, come to judge Joseph, come to blame him for their own deaths. The demons parted, and DeRoche's eyes widened as he saw a makeshift gallows had been constructed. At the very sight of Thomas's murder, just outside the dance hall. He didn't expect them to take things this far, but he knew they were not themselves. Something evil was at work. Joseph felt the breath of a man at his side. A voice growled, "Any last words?" His body was battered. His wounds stung. He was so cold. He could hardly think. He moaned, "Oh God, and apparently that was good enough for everyone. The scaffold broke when he fell. His feet touched the ground, and he rejoiced for a moment before the frozen fingers from the hand of the forest wrapped around his neck. It brutally squeezed every last breath from Joseph's body. Bodhi needed a sacrifice. Winter was a time for vengeance. No man can escape that supernatural desire. Accounts from local newspapers vary, but at 1:30 a.m. on January 16, 1881, one Joseph DeRoche, owner of the Bodhi Brickyard, followed Thomas Treloar, a local miner, from a dance at the miners' hall. DeRoche was found over Treloar's body, having shot the man in the back of the head in public. He was taken to jail, but escaped that night. A manhunt ensued, and after 2 days, he was found and returned to the jail, where a mob dragged him from his cell and strung him up at the site of the murder. A local vigilante group, the 601s, left a note on his corpse. It read, "All others take warning. Let no one cut him down. Bodhi, 601. Joseph's death changed Bodhi. The town's lawlessness gave way to order. Mike the Maneater was driven from town by the sheriff. Madame Mustache, having recently lost a huge sum, ran to the edges of town, where her hairy lip was found wet with poison. She was buried in the disreputable cemetery with the others. Bodhi, it seems, has a problem with waiting. Waiting for spring to return for gold. Waiting for a poker game to finish. Waiting for a murderer's trial. Perhaps it is this impatience that gives rise to the town spirits. Due to their misdeeds, they're denied an afterlife. And so, they wait. Wait for an end that will never come. But Bodhi's greatest evil was never its bad men. No, they placed a distant second to the Reaper, the hand of death, Winter. And in 1879, Bodhi would lose more souls to the specter than in any gunfight. We'll return to our story in just a moment. Now, our story continues. Jenny's glare has become as frosty as the ice hitting the window outside. It's nighttime, and the storm refuses to let up. Generously, the ranger has offered to let you stay the night in her bed while she takes the spare cot downstairs. After stories of men freezing to death, shooting each other, and being hanged, you doubt you'll get much sleep. The preserved gold rush town of Bodhi, California, is living up to its name as a ghost town. You lay there and listen to the intermittent wind. Jenny is asleep in the bed, and the ranger is downstairs. You descend the stairs from the apartment, back down into the visitor center. Was that a child? No, it's just the three of you in the building. It must have been the wind outside. As you arrive at the front desk, you peer behind it to see the ranger, now in an old-fashioned nightgown, asleep on a cot. You clear your throat loudly. The ranger wakes, gaining her bearings. She squints against your light, and upon realizing it's you, smiles that infuriating smile. "I assume you're here for more stories," she laughs. No one gave Maggie a second glance as she entered Wagner's saloon. Some near the door winced at the 40 below zero temperatures and 100 mile an hour winds, but just as quickly returned to their drinks, food, and games. Mama didn't like her coming here. It was true. People died here all the time. Maggie had seen it with her own eyes. Just last week, two men had hugged, only to pull out their guns and fire into one another until both were dead. She didn't care. A room full of bodies and gin was warmer than the tiny fire at home. She saddled up to the bar next to Daylight Billy, who was an agreeable man that always wore a top hat and tails. He also didn't seem to mind that Maggie was a native. Some looked up for a moment at the sound outside, though most didn't manage that. Only Maggie and Billy seemed to care enough to actually get up and look out the windows, but they couldn't see anything through the snow. The snow was coming down in droves. Something about the scream called to her, goaded her. Maggie waved Billy off, donned her coat, and went back out into the street. The wind bit at her, and her ears stung, but she pressed forward. She came across Mr. and Mrs. Tillman in the middle of Wood Street, the wife cradled in her husband's arms. Maggie followed Mr. Tillman's gaze to a row of houses where the door to the Robertsons lay ajar. Immediately, Maggie's eyes were drawn to the wood stove in the corner of the room. Mr. Robertson lay dead, his face covered in ice. Maggie nearly gagged as she saw his right arm was missing below the elbow. Squinting at the stove, she saw blast marks and realized he had tried to thaw powder in the stove. The rest of the Robertsons were frozen in bed, a giant human ice block beneath their sheets. Their skin stuck together, their lips and eyelids blue. Worst of all were the children. One wasn't 2 years old. She looked like a doll. The sheriff came, and then the caretaker, along with a few men to help. They shuffled Maggie out of the room, but not before she heard the crunching sound of the frozen bodies being pulled apart. She watched from the street as each individual body was wrapped in a sheet and placed on a cart. Once the grisly work was finished, the caretaker climbed into the driver's seat and started the horses down the avenue. Maggie turned back in the direction of the saloon, but the wind picked up again. It seemed to whisper to her, telling her to follow the carriage. She thought for a moment, then turned, heading after the caretaker. The carriage stopped just past the Miners' Union Hall in front of a barn. The mortuary was at the other end of Main Street. Watching from a nearby alley, she saw the barn doors open. They carefully lifted the first of the bodies and began to take it inside the barn. When they had gone, she snuck inside and immediately saw the reason for the caretaker's secrecy. Against the far wall were body parts, arms and heads and legs, all turned the pale blue of a frozen body. The eyes watched her with their hollow fury. The mouths were agape and wild, but the tongues, she would always remember the tongues. They hung with a rigid hunger. The icicles dripped from their tips with a ravenous cannibalism. The frozen ground made it impossible to bury the bodies. Until spring, the shed was an icebox for the dead. Maggie ran from the place. She knew the old stories. Burial rites existed for a reason. She ran and ran. Seeing that the saloons were all full, she looked for something less crowded, where she could be alone. Perhaps even to pray. The lights of a brightly decorated building with red doors called to her. Its soft music drifted through the wintry night. When she entered, Maggie immediately realized where she was. This was the infamous opium den of Tong Sing Wo. It was warm, and it smelled nice, like perfume. The Chinese decor was pleasing, wrapping the large room and various booths with scenes of cranes and flower blossoms. Tong Sing Wo turned at the sound of Maggie's entrance. He approached, asking if this was her first visit. She nodded. He guided her to a case of goods, where her eyes grew with envy at the sight of several finely embroidered handkerchiefs. He took a yellow handkerchief from the case, tying it around her neck. When she began to object, saying she couldn't pay, he shook his head and said that he was always happy to offer gifts to first-time customers. When he held the pipe to her, she remembered the dismembered bodies in the shed and tried the opium. The warmth of the room came alive and seemed to hold her, caress her. The terrible images of the bodies drifted away, hiding in the recesses of her memory. And so Maggie stayed. She smoked to forget. She smoked to hide from the frozen tongues. But as the days passed, they started to return. First, there were the icy fingers that gripped at her ankles. Then the heads that appeared when she looked in the mirror. Their blue teeth gnashed at her, asking her how she left them there. She smoked more, and they went away. Then came the tongues. Their frozen, bulbous frame hung over her as she lay in bed. Slowly they melted, dripping their hungry, desperate saliva on her clothes. That's when she fled. She raced from the den and into the night, never turning back. Maggie's parents awoke with a start to find that Maggie had returned home. She was wrapped in a blanket in the corner, rocking back and forth in great pain. She didn't want any more opium. She just wanted to come home. Maggie was fine at first, happy to be back to her boring Bodhi life. But as the days passed, the cravings began. She didn't want to eat or sleep or talk. Her curiosity was gone. As Maggie walked outside of town one day, she came upon a root that immediately caught her interest. She believed this to be the plant from which opium was extracted. It was green, a rarity in Bodhi, and had the sour smell she had come to love. She couldn't wait. She desperately needed another taste. The plant called to her. She ingested the root with glee. Hours later, as her parents came looking for her, they found her dead. A clump of poisonous parsnip in her hand. When the ranger stops talking, you emerge from your trance. You swear you were there with Maggie. You could feel the cold of the barn, full of the frozen dead. With that constant, unsettling smile, the ranger bids you a good night, laying down and turning over in her cot. Seeing that the ranger is asleep, your eyes wander to a nearby table, where a few recently discovered artifacts have yet to be placed in cases. There are some coins, a pipe, an old deck of cards. There's even a book that must have been used to teach children reading. You turn to make sure the ranger doesn't hear you playing with the items. She already is in a deep slumber. There's something in the wind that speaks to you. You know the air is frigid. You know your coat can hardly shield you from the harsh weather. But you want to see it. You feel pulled, lured. You take one glance back at the sleeping ranger and walk into the Bodhi's town center, where many ghosts and many victims of a crazed and bloody history await your arrival. Thanks for listening to Haunted Places. Don't forget to subscribe to Haunted Places on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, or any other podcast directory. If you like what you hear, leave a 5-star review or tell us what you think on social media. We're on Facebook and Instagram as @Parcast and Twitter @ParcastNetwork. It seems simple, but it really helps our show. A new episode comes out every Thursday. We'll see you next week. Haunted Places was created by Max Cutler. It's a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Ron Shapiro. With production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Haunted Places is written by Greg Castro. I'm Greg Polson.